1390 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic ABC Media
News
app.
I'm Dave Packer. It's day three of the United Auto Workers Union strike against the big three U.S. carmakers.
Workers standing outside a Ford assembly plant in Wayne, Michigan, Saturday morning, holding signs. Part of the United Auto Workers Union strike against all three big U.S. automakers. A similar scene about 50 miles away outside a Stellantis plant in Toledo, Ohio. Nearly 13,000 UAW members walked off the job Friday, a targeted strike against those plants in Ohio, Michigan, and a third in Missouri.
ABC's Allison Kosick. In Riverview, Florida, a 14-year-old boy is in custody after he shot and killed his mother, shot her boyfriend five times, and then attempted to shoot his older brother. Desperate search and recovery efforts continue in Libya after dam failures caused a catastrophic flood in the coastal city of Derna, the death toll rising to more than 11,000. An international aid effort to help those affected is ramping up. This is ABC News. A very busy week for President Biden will include a trip here to New York for the UN General Assembly. ABC News White House correspondent Mary Alice Parks with a preview.
President Zelensky will be there in person at the UN. Thursday, Zelensky actually comes back here, meets with the president at the White House in Washington. Biden's team has asked Congress for additional funding for Ukraine, but several Republican members of Congress have been threatening to hold that up.
At the UN Tuesday, Mr. Biden will address the full assembly. Wednesday, he'll meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Today marks a week since a cyber attack hit Las Vegas, and MGM hotels and casinos are still working on getting systems back up and running. The online reservation site for MGM is still down. ATMs not working. Those playing slot machines or video poker have to wait for attendants to pay to get them the cash that they won. Caesars Entertainment says they too were a victim of a cyber attack, but their online operations were not impacted. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Red Delicious, Honeycrisp, Granny Smith. If you have a favorite apple, now is the time to pick it straight from the source. Did you know Wisconsin has more than 300 apple orchards? Travel Wisconsin recently naming its favorites, including the Oneida National Apple Orchard outside Green Bay, Ferguson's Orchards in Eau Claire, and Apple Holler south of Racine. Many provide tons of family fun in the fall, too. Tire swings, lawn bowling, hay rides, and more. Apple experts suggest if you want to pick yours fresh, do it before the end of October. For Civic Media, I'm Terry.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. A new poll suggests impeaching Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Janet Protasiewicz is an unpopular idea with voters. Mike Moan reports.
A Better Wisconsin Together, a left-leaning research group, is out with new survey results showing that Wisconsinites oppose impeaching Supreme Court Justice Janet Protasiewicz by a 24-point margin. The poll was released the same day Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss announced he's putting together a panel to look at grounds for removing the judge. A Better Wisconsin Together's Mike Brown says, based on the election and the survey, such a move goes against the will of voters.
Wisconsin voters value their votes, and they expect that their legislators will respect the results of those votes. The impeachment proceedings threatening to overturn the election are very definitely in opposition to what a very strong majority of Wisconsin voters feel.
The poll of 600 registered voters conducted by a national firm was essentially evenly split in connecting with Republicans and Democrats. Voss and other Republicans have floated a possible impeachment over opposition to comments Protasiewicz made on the campaign trail regarding redistricting. Brown notes that any misgivings about what the judge said prior to the election don't carry much weight.
The Judicial Commission, which oversees and enforces court ethics, has already dismissed several baseless complaints brought by state Republicans against Justice Protasiewicz, and they declared the matter closed.
Also from the poll, 46% of Wisconsin voters think any effort to remove Protasiewicz is driven by political motivations among Republicans based on the election results. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
Do you ever get tired of one-sided conversations? Have you changed the station due to mean-spirited rhetoric? Wouldn't it be refreshing to listen and engage in civilized dialogue about politics and how issues affect our families differently? Welcome to the Rational Revolution. I'm Chris Elfheim.
And I'm Emily Sefos. Together, we'll look at today's issues through a politically purple lens. So join us on Thursday evenings from 7 to 8 on WGBW, WISS, and the Civic Media app.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. You don't know me, but I'm your brother. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning once again. It is still Saturday, September 16th, 2023. Thank you once again for joining me in this second hour of our review, our analysis, our discussion involving you of the most important news events, stories in the aspiration for justice in America, also focusing on law and government. Right before the top of the hour break, talking about the rule of law in America and the fact that one of the aspects of the rule of law, one of the institutions of our process. This past week, a federal grand jury in the District of Delaware, a federal grand jury, 26 people convened, members of our population convened to determine whether or not there was probable cause to determine whether Hunter Biden had engaged in violations of the federal gun laws, determining in the end that he had in fact done that. And so this release of the indictment against him, charging him in these three counts that he lied on this federal form that he was required to complete when he purchased a .38 caliber handgun in Delaware in 2018. Significantly, the indictment focused upon a time period after President Joe Biden had left the vice presidency and before he announced his 2020 presidential candidacy. So this is the time period that we're talking about a number of years ago. But the point, once again, is just about the rule of law. And to the extent that we acknowledge, as we always do, that individuals who are charged with violations of federal law, even state law, presumed innocent, as is Hunter Biden, until the time of an adjudication, either by a plea or a rendering of a verdict, a judgment by a federal district court judge, if you embrace the process broadly, And that means that all indictments returned by these grand jurors of our peers, finding probable cause, including the indictments and alleging violations by our former president, all of that a legitimate part of our process. And this one, again, a part of that legitimate process that brings to justice, identifying someone in our system, in this case, the son of the president of the United States of America, allegedly violating the law. Important to understand the focus of that. Also important to understand that there can be, in both the cases involving the former president, lots of motions filed. We'll talk about some of those in just a few moments or so. Motions attacking the legitimacy of the indictments, motions to seek suppression of evidence gathered in the course of the investigation, all kinds of things appropriate by defense counsel. And indeed, in this case involving Hunter Biden as well, likely there will be some attack by his attorneys. And yes, he also has a right to defend against this charge being brought by the Justice Department, basically alleging that the statute under which he has been charged, specific violation under federal law in these three counts, basically Section 924A of Title 18 of the United States Code, Section 922G, those kinds of things in the federal code, that they are unconstitutionally broad. And likely that his attorneys are going to argue that the statute itself is unconstitutional. Interestingly, the Fifth Circuit, in an unrelated but maybe somewhat related case, a three-judge panel of the Fifth Circuit, we talked about them just in connection with DACA just a few moments ago, a three-judge panel of the Fifth Circuit has sided against that law and found that it was, in fact, unconstitutional. A case involving a fellow named Patrick Daniels. Patrick Daniels, he's a Mississippi man who was convicted and sentenced to prison for possessing a firearm while being a marijuana user. So similar charges there in Mississippi. Fifth Circuit finding that that conviction could not stand. Now, specifically related to the facts of the case, the law in question, again, prohibits anyone from who is an unlawful user of or addicted to any controlled substance from owning a firearm. That's what Hunter Biden's also charged with. The appeals court panel ruled that it was too broad and that was used in at least Daniel's case, and so they tossed out that conviction. The appeals court's ruling, of course, applies just to Mississippi and Texas and Louisiana. Those are the states in the Fifth Circuit. But came after the Supreme Court issued this very broad opinion that we talked about just this the previous summer, not this past summer, in a case called Bruin, focusing on the historical focus for legislation. And so it may well be that the attorneys who are representing Hunter Biden will use that Fifth Circuit case to charge and allege that the very statute under which Hunter Biden has been indicted is unconstitutional. We will see. But that, again, a part of the process going forward. And we embrace that for all defendants. Again, recognizing human tragedy related to this kind of prosecution, this investigation, but also an enforcement of and embracing of the process by which our nation moves forward, even in the very difficult and challenging and very often uncomfortable and unpleasant investigation, prosecution of crime, a necessary part of ensuring that we're safe and secure in this country. We always, during the course of our 2 hours on Saturday morning, encourage your phone calls at 844-967-2789. And we also encourage your text to us, again, through the app and through the website of Civic Media. We did have a text during the course of our first hour from Mary in Mount Horeb. I want to acknowledge that. Thank you, Mary, for texting in. She was focusing upon our previous discussion about DACA and the DACA program. Again, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, the subject of this decision by Andrew Hannon of the Federal District Court in Houston, finding that the present president's attempt to establish new rules to resurrect, to revive, to keep in place DACA was improperly done, and therefore sending this now on to the Fifth Circuit for its review, presumably maybe down the road by the Supreme Court itself. This DACA program had benefited more than 800,000 young people during the course of the last 11 years or so. Right now, about 600,000 of them, 600,000 people are enrolled. Many of them now young adults. The average age of recipients was 21 when DACA was established. Many of them, most of them are now in their 30s. And indeed, Mary from Mount Horeb writes in and tells us about a friend's daughter-in-law. Who herself has been the recipient of DACA benefits, not being deported under the program, brought here plainly as a young person, as a youth, as a minor, reports that she is now 27 years old. And here's the story. Here's the reason why DACA is so important to our life and our livelihood here in America. The story that Mary tells us from Mount Horeb about her friend's daughter-in-law, apparently married, raising a family. She is employed. She has done all those good and right things that we think about when we think about American residency and citizenship here as well for all of us. That's the story. That's the reason for DACA being put in place by President Obama in the first place, to find a path forward for people who will be good and proper and wonderful and inspiring members of our citizenry. Mary's friend's daughter-in-law among that group, 27 years old. And also describes along the way the many things that she has had to do during the course of the past 11 years in agreeing to and abiding by and following all of these various rules and regulations that DACA appropriately, but nonetheless, requires of all of the DACA recipients, including this particular young woman, now 27 years old, a good and contributing member of our society, presumably there in Mount Horeb or someplace here in the state of Wisconsin. We appreciate very much not only the report, Mary, about your friend's daughter-in-law, but we recognize it is one of hundreds of thousands of people who are out there who are looking again. This is the only nation, the only land that they have ever known, and should in fact be the recipients of not only this kind of thing. The ultimate answer, of course, as we have said before in our continuing civics education here, the United States Congress should, in the end, adopt an omnibus immigration law, an omnibus set of rules and regulations, protocols that address what? They address border security, which, yes, indeed, is an issue in America. They need to address immigration status of all sorts of people who are here illegally, who are here legally, who are waiting for long periods of time to get their cases adjudicated. We've talked in the past about the asylum seekers. Those issues need to be addressed. All kinds of things. We have come close in recent years, and yet we fail to pass that as a legislative entity in Washington, D.C. That needs to be the focus of our federal Congress. It needs to be a focus of our president. And yes, indeed, to the extent that executive orders in the interim address these issues that, again, focus upon humanity, that's what our presidents need to do. But it should not replace legislation properly intended by our founding fathers to address this issue, immigration on the category of things of the docket of our United States Congress, the House and the Senate itself. Those are the folks who should be attending to this. In the interim, we look forward to perhaps the Supreme Court adopting a position that says, yes, indeed, the executive branch, the president, way back in 2012, the current president with the new rule has the authority to do this. That's what the Supreme Court should do in this time when the United States Congress fails to do what it should, in fact, be doing. We have talked again this morning, as we have in the past, about indictments, this important process that gets the ball rolling, if you will, after investigation, presentation to a grand jury, a finding of probable cause, heading toward jury trials. Again, a public proceeding, grand juries not public. They are private under Rule 6E of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. That's an appropriate process. We've talked about the reasons for that, the notion that people should be investigated, if at all, by a grand jury without suffering the public notoriety of those investigations. There are exceptions to that rule when, in fact, the United States population, a state population, knows about an investigation. And it is good and right for state and federal prosecutors to let the community know that matters are under investigation without describing with particularity the specifics of the investigation, without commenting about who is saying what, but confirming for the population generally that the investigation is going ahead. Why do we do that in those circumstances where it's appropriate to do it? You assure the public that the matter is being attended to. Even if you can't describe exactly what's going on, you don't hide behind the notion that because a matter is under investigation, you can say nothing about it. We often say in the Department of Justice and in state and federal prosecutions, you can't comment upon the pendency or lack of pendency of investigation. That's the rule normally. But when there's something that is the focus of general attention, well known, for example, we've talked a lot about this program about the fake electors here in Wisconsin and other places. You can, in fact, ensure the population that those kinds of things are the focus of investigations. We're going to talk more about fake electors again, as I said, in our next broadcast next Saturday as we return to many of the things that are the subject of those indictments. Among them, the cases right now pending against our former President Donald Trump. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Manhattan civil case, and then we're going to get back to that federal case being overseen by Judge Tanya Chutkan in the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia. Stay with us for that discussion right after this break.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
More than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio each month for news, weather, and emergency information. A new bill in Congress would make sure AM radio remains in cars. Because when cell and internet services are down, this free service could be your only lifeline. Text AM to 52886 and tell Congress to support the AM Radio for Every Vehicle Act.
Message and data rates may apply. You may receive up to 4 messages a month, and you may text STOP to STOP.
This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
The Cripes Cast with Charlie Behrens.
Today, I am talking to the owner of Funky Fresh Spring Rolls, my friend, Truman McGee.
From an environmentally friendly perspective, yeah. The fact that it's frozen means that it's not going to waste.
I am a cereal strawberry abuser. If you're a fruit and you're watching this, stay away from me, okay? Do not jump in my shopping cart, because I will let you die.
Cripes Cast every Saturday and Sunday at noon across Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
If I could be you.
And you could be me.
For just 1 hour.
If you could find a way.
To get inside.
Each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
Cannolis, we're talking about a number of different issues, principally in the courts now, of our federal and state systems. Talking now about these cases pending against our former President Donald Trump. Some significant things happening in the jurisdiction of Manhattan, in New York in particular, and also in the Federal District Court in the District of Columbia just this past week. You recall well, we have talked about this at some great length, that in a civil case, again, not a criminal case, a civil case brought by Letitia James, she is the Attorney General of the State of New York. She has brought this civil case charging that Donald Trump and his children, Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump, and initially Ivanka Trump as well, although she has been dismissed from the case, and some other top Trump organization executives were also engaged in some asset valuations, sometimes changing the valuations of various real estate holdings of theirs, depending upon whether they're seeking insurance, whether they're seeking valuations, tax credits, basically fixing books, if you will, changing the records of the actual established values of various properties that are owned in violation of the civil law in the state of New York. The attorney general there bringing this lawsuit, seeking not only $250 million in damages against the Trump organization, again, these top Trump organization executives, but also seeking to prohibit the former president and his sons, Eric and Donald, from ever again running a business in that state. All a part of the penalties as a part of the prosecution, the civil prosecution being brought. And the case has been presented to New York Supreme Court Justice Arthur Engoron. Again, in this state of New York, Supreme Court justices are the trial judges. That's the name for them in the state of New York. And he has repeatedly vowed that an October 2nd date, which is coming up very soon, will be kept, as he says, come hell or high water. And Judge Engoron has repeatedly rejected all of Donald Trump's previous efforts to limit the case on statute of limitations grounds, basically saying that these allegations are much too old. They predate his time in office. And he said that the positions articulated by the Trump lawyers simply are meant to delay the prosecution of the case, and they're completely without merit, according to Judge Engoron. Well, this past week, an appeals court judge there in New York, his name is David Friedman, put that trial date at least somewhat in jeopardy. And he said, you know what, we're going to have a full appellate panel review this issue about whether or not the case is too old and these fraud allegations, which include these financial documents about valuations of real estate, going back to way to 2011, whether they're too old, and that any trial therefore has to be severely limited in scope to the more recent things, if not canceled outright. That's what the request that the former president's attorneys are making. And this David Friedman, this associate justice now in the appellate level, has said, well, we'll take a look at that. And at least for right now, that has raised questions about whether or not this trial happening on October 2nd will in fact go. It remains on the docket right now, but at least for the next couple of weeks, a lot of activity there being argued to the appeals court, again, on behalf of the state of New York, there in Manhattan, specifically by Letitia James and by her attorneys there, that the case should proceed in all of its broad, expansive charges against the former president, his children, and the organization leaders themselves, and obviously defended against by the former president's attorneys, who maintain that it is simply too old. The appeals court will plainly make a decision and suspect that if indeed they affirm the right of the prosecution, the state here, to go ahead with its trial, strong indication that Judge Arthur Engoron, again, the trial judge, will in fact begin to impanel a jury on October 2nd, coming up very, very soon. October 2nd, also a significant date in rule of law history in America. Why? Because it's on October 2nd that the new term of our United States Supreme Court begins. And we will be spending some time in our broadcasts in the month of October talking about some of the cases coming up. Already 23 cases on the docket of the United States Supreme Court, some significant cases involving things as fundamental as the constitution of federal entities and how they're formulated, other things related to criminal and civil practice, a great number of things. We'll talk about those in the future as well. October 2nd, we'll see what happens in that case out coming out of New York. We'll also be watching the United States Supreme Court, as we always do, and talking in those future broadcasts, of course, necessarily about this continuing issue that does not go away about ethics before the United States Supreme Court involving Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito and arguably others, not yet resolved. And yet the subject of continuing focus in our media, all of that coming up, program notes down the road. As always, we appreciate your texts, your phone calls as well. We've got a caller on the line, been waiting for a while. Danny, glad to have you with us this morning. Your comment, your question, your thought for our consideration this morning on Morning Cannolis. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely.
I've got to come to you in four or five different levels. I need some information, and I'm thinking you're the person to go to.
We'll see whether that's true or not, but we'll focus on maybe one or two of those today, and maybe we can take the others offline. But go ahead, Danny, your thoughts or comments.
No, this will be easy.
Sure.
I'm not going to go into questions. I'm just talking about levels.
Okay.
I'm sitting here with a letter from the president, which is off the response that I would expect it from the president. And he's talking in five paragraphs about making right on the death penalty. Let's not do the death penalty. Well, I agree with that. But the whole thing is, it's rather surprising to me, especially considering it was out of context of what I sent to him. But what I'm wondering about it's like this. I'm wondering about the jail situation, and are they getting, aren't they, I heard at a point that they were full.
Okay, and Danny, I've got to go to a break in just a moment or so. I'm going to have you stay on the line. We'll talk right after this break about the letter or the correspondence between you and the president. That's terrific, about the death penalty and some other issues as well. Stay with me. Danny, if you will, and everybody else, stay with me as well. We'll continue this conversation right after this break.
Mino and the Mayor in the morning, and the talk of Green Bay all day long. 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. It's day three of the United Auto Workers Union strike against the big three U.S. car makers.
Workers standing outside a Ford assembly plant in Wayne, Michigan Saturday morning holding signs. Part of the United Auto Workers Union strike against all three big U.S. automakers. A similar scene about 50 miles away outside a Stellantis plant in Toledo, Ohio. Nearly 13,000 UAW members walked off the job Friday, a targeted strike against those plants in Ohio, Michigan, and a third in Missouri.
ABC's Allison Kosick. In Riverview, Florida, a 14-year-old boy is in custody after he shot and killed his mother, shot her boyfriend five times, and then attempted to shoot his older brother. Desperate search and recovery efforts continue in Libya after dam failures caused a catastrophic flood in the coastal city of Derna. The death toll rising to more than 11,000. An international aid effort to help those affected is ramping up. This is ABC News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
From the kennel to the coop, whatever the season, Fleet Farm has everything to keep your animals happy and healthy. From training your pup to sit season, to mastering those retrieval skills season. From clipping your horse for competition season, to keeping the backyard birds well-fed season. And of course, loving your pets like family season. There's a reason people say, if Fleet Farm doesn't have it, you don't need it. Because we have it all. Fleet Farm, built for real life.
Mino and the Mayor.
We're talking with Tony Mandrich. You're talking about your alcohol problems. Jim kind of mentioned here during the break. He said, yeah, the coaches didn't do anything about it. And I said, didn't do anything about it. They were with the guys.
I mean, nobody forced anybody to drink. Drinking was just part of it. And it was kind of like that stereotype of, you know, being a guy or being an athlete, or it was just part of that.
Mino and the Mayor. Weekday mornings from 6 until 8 on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS.
And on the Civic Media app.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Yeah. Todd Albo would normally be sharing his dulcet tones with us, but you'll recall that last week, Todd was having issues with the cable company, with an internet connection. I'm now thinking, Todd Albo, did you break Spectrum? Are you responsible for this ESPN mess?
I seem to have broke everything else, so it wouldn't surprise me, no.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Weekday morning, 6 till 8.
On your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the US Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUS Kids, and the Ad Council.
It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Crute.
Weekdays from 4 until 6
on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Issues specifically related to the rule of law in America. Right before the break, talking with Danny. Danny, I hope you're still there. You were chatting with me about some correspondence that you're having with the President of the United States of America. Glad to hear that. A strong advocate always on this broadcast for people reaching out to their elected representatives, including the President of the United States of America, to let them know how you feel about things. I think you indicated that you're in correspondence with the President about the death penalty. A little bit of background on that, of course. The United States Supreme Court has said that the Eighth Amendment prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment does not prohibit the states from enacting legislation that permits the death penalty to be imposed. That's a state decision by state legislatures and plainly signed off by governors as well. Here in Wisconsin, we do not have the death penalty. That has not been our history, but plainly other states around the nation do in fact have that. And one of the important things that the Supreme Court has said is that when it comes to the imposing the death penalty for those states that have decided to adopt it as a part of its jurisprudential plan, its law enforcement practice, all sorts of processes and procedures. Why?
because, of course, you don't want to get that wrong. And that's the reason why there are all sorts of appropriate appellate procedures, all sorts of reviews that can be conducted, all sorts of judicial examinations of what happened at trial courts. This is also why the United States Supreme Court, even during this time when it's not issuing major decisions, will often issue decisions that temporarily may stay orders to execute individuals in those states where the death penalty does apply. All kinds of litigation, all kinds of legislation out there related to the death penalty. And glad to hear, Danny, that you're involved in this issue. Sounds like you're opposed to the death penalty and expressing that to the president. He and other presidents of recent times, not including Donald Trump, have advocated against the death penalty in America. Plainly one of those issues that continues to be the focus of a lot of debate in our nation. But Danny, you indicated that you had at least that issue and maybe one other discussed with me this morning. Glad to have you with me.
Yes, I'm still on the line.
Great.
I've got this question. You could put this one aside because I have a comment, but let's get back to the fact of can death penalties if people get retrialed. I know they have a pardon base in the pardon board in the process of things, but I'm wondering if they can get retrialed and not face the death penalty, but face life imprisonment.
Sure.
But let me get to something else.
Okay, go ahead. Make your other point. Sure, go ahead.
This may date me, but I remember when people, I'm talking about street people. Some street people would rather have been in jail enjoying the luxuries of the jail and like this one sentence here says, they're getting access to housing, mental health, substance abuse treatment, education and job training. Well, you know, there are, I don't know how many people in the California area that are street people that, you know, would enjoy a place to stay.
So a couple of comments. Yeah, Danny, I'm going to interrupt just because I think you raised some good issues, obviously, for focus. I will tell you again with respect to the death penalty issue that, yes, indeed, when courts review what happens at lower district court levels, trial court levels, and finds that there's some error based upon evidentiary decisions, other things, jury deliberations, all kinds of things, courts can, in fact, send cases back for trials. And that's why we go through all these processes before we impose a death penalty. That, indeed, can be the process. And let me comment more generally about your comments about folks who are homeless out there. And part of the response I always make to this is, yes, indeed. Homelessness, not only in the state of Wisconsin, around our nation, continues to be a significant problem. We do absolutely need to address those issues in providing the kinds of education, housing, of course, a key aspect of that, jobs, those kinds of things, mental health counseling, other types of health support. And that's why, again, decisions about who we send to our Congress, who we send to our state legislatures, so important in providing those kinds of programs out there. I will say, and I don't know that you articulated this specifically, but I would never, ever want to say that incarceration is a remedy for homelessness. Absolutely not. And that the most significant thing that a government can do when it comes to affecting your rights and liberties and freedoms in America is to incarcerate you, right? To take away your freedom. We should always, always attempt and always be successful if we can. Of ensuring that services and programs for our homeless populations, people who are out there and need that kind of support, should not be brought into the judicial system, should not be the source of the focus or the target of investigations, certainly not criminal prosecutions, those kinds of things. There are wonderful things that can happen once we make the decision that investigations of people who have committed crimes and are in prison, rehabilitation there, absolutely. Education, providing the mechanisms, reentry programs, we do a lot of that inside the Department of Justice, all those kinds of things, hugely supportive of that. But we don't want to in any way equate problems associated with homelessness and find that the resolution of that or solution to that would in any way be investigation and criminal prosecution and incarceration. But Danny, appreciate very much the comment. I know we've got a lot more on your agenda, and we'll look forward to chatting with you around down the road as well. Appreciate that comment and all the other comments brought to us this morning on Morning Cannolis. We have been talking again about these cases involving our former president. Chatted earlier about the indictment against Hunter Biden by a grand jury. We also have the indictment brought in the United States District Court in the District of Columbia against Donald Trump. This principal among the four indictments, this principal indictment against him for his involvement, he's the singular defendant in that case, involving his activities, his conduct, various charges, basically robbing or attempting to rob the American population of its right to a proper electoral college count. And we know that that case is pending right now, scheduled for a March trial, March of 2024, in front of a judge named Tanya Chutkan. She's been on the bench for about 10 years or so, very, very astute and experienced judge. Previously, before that, represented people on the defense side. Again, a key important part of our system to defense attorneys, prosecutors, judges, witnesses, court staff, a victim witness specialist, all kinds of people out there to make this system go. Judge Chutkan, again, has scheduled this case for trial in March. And now, as we have talked about before, is focusing a lot upon these pretrial matters, including, although we haven't heard about them yet, all kinds of motions that are sure to come by the defense, a part of their appropriate process in our system, challenging the indictment brought by the grand jury there, being prosecuted by Jack Smith, the special counsel, the federal case involving January 6th, involving our former president, and also naming, without their names being particularly identified, but identifying nonetheless six other unindicted co-conspirators, including one of them named Jeffrey Clark. Well, this past week, a couple of things happened without clear resolution yet. We know that at the time of an initial hearing in front of Judge Chutkan, the judge told Donald Trump specifically that she would not tolerate any remarks from the former president that might intimidate witnesses or prejudice potential jurors. She said, "I would caution you and your client," that is, she's speaking to the Donald Trump's attorneys. She cautioned them and your client to take special care in your public statements in this case. She said, "I will take whatever measures are necessary to protect the integrity of these proceedings." And indeed, just this past week, just yesterday, the government, the prosecution, Jack Smith, special counsel, as a part of a large document, a 19-page document, much of which focused upon the former president's continuing to attack who? To attack the judge, saying that she is corrupt, attacking the prosecutor, saying he is deranged, which he has said now a number of times, and most significantly, saying things about prospective witnesses and potential jurors, the juror pool out there generally as well, specifically the things that Judge Chutkan has said you cannot comment about. What prompted the government now to file a motion just yesterday, now seeking a limited gag order, basically saying you need to tell the defendant, Donald Trump, specifically with great detail, and there are four specific things in this request made by Jack Smith to the judge outlining specifically what the government feels she should do to stop him from continuing to intimidate prospective witnesses, known out there by virtue of the discovery presented to the defendant through his attorneys, and also significantly potentially affecting the jury pool in Washington, D.C., by virtue of the things that he is saying and doing, great deal of detail set forth in 17 of these 19 pages in front of the judge. She has directed that Donald Trump's attorneys respond to that, and now the issue is clearly raised, whether or not the defendant will in fact be gagged, if you will. I know that that's not necessarily a legal term, but basically told you cannot do these kinds of things. Your First Amendment rights do not include intimidation of witnesses and affecting the jury pool. Donald Trump, as late as yesterday, again, tweeting actually on his social media focus, his most social media platform, saying that the government is trying to affect his First Amendment rights. The answer is no. You've got a First Amendment right. You can talk about the fact that you feel strongly that you are being prosecuted improperly, that you're innocent. You can talk generally about the ways in which you may be feeling completely attacked by this. What you can't do is talk about particular witnesses and attempt to affect the jury pool by making what are threatening comments and attempts to, again, affect the course of justice. There's a difference between those two things. But the former president said last night about his First Amendment right, it is limited, as are all of our rights in America. You can't do what Jack Smith is now identifying in this pleading. We'll see what Tanya Chutkan does, presumably sometime soon, in addressing this continuing effort by the former president to influence jurors, harass witnesses in this case, intimidate witnesses in this case. We'll continue to focus on that as well. And second, as if not to be outdone by the defense in this case, Trump's lawyers themselves are seeking the recusal of Judge Chutkan. That motion filed on Monday, 4 days or so before the attempt to stop the defendant from speaking as he has been doing, asking the federal judge herself to recuse herself. Presumably, she is not going to do that, a very risky gambit by the Trump legal team, alleging that in the course of her sentencing various individuals who've been tried and convicted for January 6th violations, that she has said things that somehow show some animus, some bias against the former president. They do not. But in particular, alleging that in the course of her sentencing of a woman named Christine Priola, a former occupational therapist in Cleveland, she said the people who mobbed the Capitol on January 6th showed blind loyalty to one person who, by the way, remains free to this day. That's the comment by Judge Chutkan in that previous proceeding way back in October of last year, again, sentencing Christine Priola at that time, also alleging that Judge Chutkan showed some bias against the former president in establishing the terms and conditions of a sentence imposed in December of 2021, as when she sentenced a Florida man who had hurled a fire extinguisher at police officers that day. We talked about that defendant, his name Robert Palmer. She said at that time that people exhorted you and encouraged you and rallied you to go and take action and to fight have not been charged. That is a statement of fact. And she said those things during the course of those proceedings. They're public proceedings, not at all the basis for recusal. Nonetheless, a Trump attorney's seeking to have her recused based upon those statements that she has made in the past. That motion almost certainly going nowhere. Anticipate that in addition to Judge Chutkan resolving this much thornier issue related to the terms and conditions under which Donald Trump can continue to exercise his First Amendment rights without running afoul of the basic trappings of the rule of law, she's also got before this recusal request. She will deny that, as would any judge, and the case will go ahead again to address these other more substantive things in the days, the weeks, and the months ahead before the March trial coming up in next year. When we come back, when we return to that indictment, that underlying indictment before Judge Chutkan, before a jury, a trial jury impaneled by Judge Chutkan in the coming spring. Stay with us for that final discussion in our final segment here on Morning Cannolis.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Don't let biased algorithms or degree screens or exclusive professional networks or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight. The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
All of these things consistently come down to this: willingness of people to give up their agency and the willingness of Donald Trump and those who support him to leverage and abuse people's trust in them to further their own personal power and enrichment.
The Maggie Dawn Show, weeknights at 6 p.m. on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
Welcome back to this, our final segment this morning on Morning Cannolis. And as we have done in the past, I want to revisit this major indictment against the former president, again, pending in the Federal District Court in the District of Columbia. We have chatted in prior broadcasts about other components of it. It is lengthy, but it is readable. It is a so-called talking indictment because it tells you the story of what happened. In the past, we have talked about the fact that in this indictment, in the first pages, it raises this issue about First Amendment rights, indicating that there's a difference between the First Amendment and advocating an insurrection. We talked about the fake electors and the allegations there as well. We're going to revisit that again, a programming note, next Saturday again, as we talk about what's going on in Wisconsin, other states there, having to do with fake electors, whether they're going to be charged in our state and federal systems. And we've also chatted about this intent issue in the past, the things that have been said to the former president that established that he knew, in fact, the things he was saying about the 2020 election being stolen are not, in fact, true. Why is that important, as we've talked before? Because at the time of the trial, coming up presumably in March, the prosecution is going to have to establish that there was intent, that Donald Trump, the singular defendant in this case, had the intent to do exactly what's charged in here in these four counts and set forth at great detail. And it's that leads me to then focus upon another major portion of this indictment that we have not yet gotten to. But I think it's important always to understand, again, the nature of what was going on here. All of this, once again, going to those issues, going to the issue of intent, understanding by the defendant, Donald Trump, about what was going on, and also along the way, identifying the ways in which the former president almost used and attempted to use the Department of Justice to accomplish his end, principally through what's been identified as unindicted conspirator number four. And his name is Jeffrey Clark. Jeffrey Clark. Who was Jeffrey Clark? Jeffrey Clark was a high-level administrator. He was an assistant attorney general, responsible for some of the civil areas, including the Environmental and Natural Resources Division, later on in charge of the civil division itself, a huge, huge responsibility there, a major, major player in the management of the U.S. Department of Justice. And what does the indictment say about him? Again, not named in the indictment. He is named, for what it is worth, in the Georgia indictment, among the 18, 19 people there. In this indictment, however, it describes him as a number four, among these unindicted co-conspirators. In particular, the allegations in the indictment say this. In late December of 2020, right after the election, the Donald Trump attempted to use the Justice Department to make knowingly false claims of election fraud to officials in the targeted states. We know who those are, the six or seven states, through a formal letter under the acting attorney general's signature, thus giving the defendants, the Donald Trump's lies, the backing of the federal government, and attempting to improperly influence those targeted states to replace legitimate Biden electors with Donald Trump's own. And specifically, this letter, the acting attorney general, let's give him a name. His name is Jeffrey Rosen. And there's also an acting deputy attorney general who plays in this. His name is Richard Donahue. All of these people, in many ways, as set forth in the allegations, once again, in this indictment, the people who are quite literally standing up to the president in these late days of 2020, the early days of 2021, pushing back against the president as set forth in this indictment, against this notion that there had been voter theft, voter fraud in the course of the election itself, and refusing to permit the Department of Justice to be reused, pushing back on the defendants, Donald Trump's attempts, and also pushing back on the attempts by their own colleague, Jeffrey Clark, actually a lower level supervisor inside the Department of Justice. This is a situation where the Attorney General himself supervising Jeffrey Clark. We've got Jeffrey Clark making specific entrees, specific outreach to the president in an attempt to get a letter written and also to have himself, that is Jeffrey Clark, placed in position of responsibility and authority there as the Attorney General. How does this play out? Well, it says on December 22nd, Donald Trump met with Jeffrey Clark of the White House. Clark did not inform the Justice Department leadership, his bosses, Jeffrey Rosen and Richard Donahue, of the meeting, which was itself a violation of the protocols and procedures inside the Department of Justice. December 27th, Donald Trump calls the acting attorney general, again, Jeff Rosen, Richard Donahue, and says, you know, people tell me that Jeffrey Clark is great. I should put him in. That's what he says to his attorney general and his acting deputy attorney general. The president at that time also raises multiple false claims of election fraud, as he's done before. And both Rosen and Donahue push back on that, according to the indictment. This is page 28, paragraph 74. Both of them tell the defendant, tell Donald Trump, the Justice Department could not and would not change the outcome of the election. Nothing about what you're proposing, Mr. President, is going to happen. And the president at that time, according to the allegations in the indictment, said, just say that the election was corrupt and leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman. That's what he says to the acting attorney general, Jeff Rosen, and to the deputy. December 28th. In the wake of that conversation, pushing back again against the former president, Jeffrey Clark sends this draft letter to the acting attorney general, Rosen, the acting deputy attorney general, proposes they all sign it. What does the draft say? Basically, it's addressed to state officials in Georgia, and he proposes sending versions of it to various officials in those targeted states. It's indeed this activity that in part gets Jeffrey Clark in trouble in Georgia, which is the focus of the Georgia indictment there, and includes various statements that are knowingly false. So that is, the Justice Department has identified significant concerns that may have impacted the outcome of the election in multiple states. The Justice Department believes that in Georgia and those other states, valid electors had gathered at a proper location and had sent ballots to the transmitted to Congress, and that those ballots should have been advanced to the Electoral College voting on that day. Said the Justice Department urged the state legislatures convene a special legislative session to create this opportunity to choose the fraudulent electors over legitimate electors, all that in this letter. On December 31st, the former president summons to the Oval Office, again, Jeffrey Rosen and Donahue and other advisors. In that meeting, Donald Trump again raises claims about this election fraud and that the Justice Department had already pushed back on in this previous meeting. And the senior Justice Department officials reiterated were false once again, December 31st. And Donald Trump at that time suggested once again they might change the leadership in the Department of Justice. On January 2nd, just 4 days before January 6th, of course, before that certification proceeding, Jeffrey Clark tries to coerce his boss, the attorney general, and the acting attorney general to send that letter, which contained those false statements to the state officials, ultimately leading to an encounter with the president late on January 3rd, January 4th, in which the former president once again expresses frustration about the possibility of the Department of Justice not doing anything. When we come back next week, we'll talk more about that particular aspect of this indictment, explain why it is that's important to understand the Department of Justice today and in the past. We'll encourage your phone calls, your questions, as always, invite you back for that all-important discussion about the rule of law, government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Thank you for joining me today. Looking forward to your future participation in our broadcast. Take care, everybody.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
100 degrees.
Ramaswamy literally said global climate change, human and affected climate change is a hoax.
Ron DeSantis effectively pivoted on the debate stage, said, I'm not going to answer your damn question because it will expose us as climate change denialists, which puts them in a minority, certainly with younger voters. Young people care about the future of this world, though.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6
on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Fritos, Cheetos, Doritos. We should expect that stuff to be safe. Why does it make sense that corporations can poison the American people and we don't even know about it? Politically, there is a group who chooses to make sure that there are not enough dollars put into the Food and Drug Administration to check on these types of things.
The Earl Ingram Show. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media
News,
app.
I'm Dave Pe-